Like a live-action South Park, in honor of Good Boys, what adventure from your childhood should have been the basis for a movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and technically I was a teenager when this happened, but it still counts. But there was a snow day, and then I was at the end of high school, and all of my neighbors and all of my parents and their friends all got together and drank all day. And then one of the middle-aged men fell off of the back of a golf cart and split his chin open. Whoa. And they determined that no one was sober enough to drive to the dermatologist's office, but the dermatologist was sober enough to give stitches. So I drove a car full of drunk middle-aged men to the dermatologist's office and watched drunken stitches happen. And I feel like it could make a good story about cross-generational relationships and
drunken stitches. Names itself.
Learning that the boys who are stupid when you're in high school maybe don't get any smarter when you get older, but they were still very nice to me.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm just going to say woods porn. And if you,
I really thought you were going to explain more.
Nope. I feel like if you listen to this and you know what woods porn is, you know what woods porn is. And if you don't know what woods porn is, Google woods porn. It's not actually. It's safe for work. You can Google woods porn.
Oh, I'm pretty
and
sure.
Read
that
the articles and read the articles.
Yeah, I just read
some of those results will not be safe for work.
Yeah, I just look at woods porn for the articles.
I'm Dave Gonzalez, and this didn't happen to me specifically, but one of my childhood friends broke his leg sledding in a blizzard, and his other friends had to like drag him home on a sled, and then one of their poor mothers had to drive him to the hospital. I feel like it's a good premise for a chat movie.
I feel like all of my answers for this are probably way too long for the purposes of an introductory segment. So can I also take the Matt Patches route and just go with code and
who
say,
who are you? You didn't even say your name.
Oh.
Oh yeah.
I am he, David Ehrlich. And I just want to say OJ Simpson.
Wow. You were in the Bronco?
I was in the Bronco, baby. Zoom in.
I think they did. Yeah.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine. I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 269, and it is the week of August 14th, 2019.
Nice.
Someone was going to do it. It's the week that in 1965, Sonny and Cher's I Got You, Babe hit number one on the Billboard charts.
I was nice. Just listening to that song on the SiriusXM Broadway channel.
Do any
part
of you
the Cher musical.
On the Broadway channel.
Yeah, it's on part of the Cher musical.
This is a safe space. Do any of you refer to your partners as babe?
No.
Do
you?
Oh, God, no. I would sooner die. I wouldn't even associate with anyone who would dare to do such a
thing.
That
feels like a real, like, Instagram influencer thing.
No, but it goes back to Sonny and Cher, clearly, if not before.
I mean, they were the original Instagram influencers.
Anyway, from a completely non-judgmental place, you're basically a terrorist if you do that.
Stop doing this to yourselves and your partners.
And babe. To me, if I have to hear.
I'm
going to
call you babe.
Once we eradicate all the babes, I will move on to the true enemy, honey. But that's another battle for another day. Yeah,
and then onward to all joy.
Yes.
Welcome back, David. Hope you had a great and restful vacation.
Oh, me and my honey babe had a great.
Yeah, how was your babe?
we went to Iceland and.
What's the Icelandic word for
you know what, I, you know what I learned about Iceland? It's a babe. Iceland is fucking great, man.
It's great.
What a country. We had the best time.
Puffin's doing well?
Puffins were not really on my radar as a thing, I don't think, prior to going. And now they are all I can see when I close my eyes. Just puffins everywhere. Mm. We even brought a wood-carved puffin home that was made by a local crime writer that we bought on an island off the coast of Iceland. His name is
Norman. It's definitely going to haunt you. You know that, right?
No, Norman's adorable. Norman loves us and we love him. Iceland was really amazing. And if anyone ever has the opportunity to go rent a car, drive around the southern coast, maybe pop over to the western peninsula by Budir, which was a crazy place. What a country. We had a great time. We can't wait to go back.
If you're listening in Iceland, please let us know. I would love to know if we
have I did go to Iceland's one and only art house cinema in Reykjavik, the Bio Paradise. And I didn't see a movie there, but I saw what they were playing. The programming seemed really solid, and the atmosphere seemed lovely. It seemed like a good place. I'm a fan.
Well, welcome back. I hear we have some reviews from people got really inspired while you were gone.
They do. All these positive reviews. Yeah, all these positive reviews pour in the moment I vacate the country. Thank you. Message received. MCU ISOC says, great pod. Found this pod on accident. Gonna stop you right there, MCU ISOC. So first we have Babe.
It's a positive review, David.
Nope.
Shut up.
No. Nope. First we have Babe, then we have Honey, and then once all the Honeys are dead, I'm moving on to people who say on accident instead of by accident. But you have a long time before I get there, MCU
ISOC. Is that like so online? Okay. That might be just a geographic difference. In New York, people say online instead of inline.
And I am guilty of that, and I will kill myself when the time comes, but it is that is not the same. Anyway, MCU ISOC recognized Katie's voice from Little Gold Men!
Hey!
Such a relaxed and conversational podcast to listen to between checking out good movies. Could you possibly do an episode over psychedelic themes and influences in film? This review was helpful. It was a great suggestion. Maybe we could do a segment about that one day if there is a movie or.
I want to watch that Amazon show Undone by the guy, the BoJack creator, where she's like, it's the Scanner Darkly rotoscope style. And she's, that's all psychedelic. Yeah. That's a
mini segment on Pink Floyd's The Wall.
I've never seen Pink Floyd's The Wall. You can do a live commentary track watching Wizard of Oz and listen to The Wall. No, that seems like a bad way to first experience
The Wall. Now you have to see the animated movie so you can see the plant sex.
We are going to stick to Patch's suggestion. Please don't say that again. good idea. We'll revisit that when Undone comes out. Maynard Oddity says, thank you. I'm a 19-year-old who's working at a FedEx center during the summer, and with long, weird hours, podcasts seem like the only thing to fill the time. And while there was some trial and error in terms of which podcast to find, I finally found this one by way of Blank Check. And this one is really great. Thank you for making this podcast so I can focus on something other than cardboard boxes of varying widths and sizes. And Maynard Oddity, don't forget, of course, the arrow hidden in the FedEx logo. I'm sure it haunts you in every waking hour when you're surrounded by all those boxes. This review was very helpful. I hope it's been as helpful to you. It's been as helpful. This review has been as helpful for us as our show
did
to you.
Inspire him?
Boy.
Working a boring job is how I started listening to podcasts, too. So time-honored tradition.
What was your boring job? Vanity Fair?
It was my first, my first job out of college, which was a very good job in a lot of ways, but also involved a lot of just like updating a database.
And so podcast
to all of this American Life streaming from the This American Life website.
Maynard Oddity, I just want to follow up on Patch's point and say that if you ever find yourself on a deserted island with one FedEx box, it may have sentimental or symbolic value to you. I really, and I can't stress this enough, recommend that you open the box. Maybe it will be useless to you, but there is a chance it could help you and save your life. So it's just some advice from your elders who have been watching movies for too long. Gelifin 278 says, love the pod. Last year I followed Dave 7 here from Storm of Spoilers, which is that all three of these reviews have been the roads here. Yeah, it's great. Which has since become The Storm, a lost rewatch podcast. My lightning thunder sounds. And I'm glad I stuck around. Thank you for all your hard work, y'all. Smiley face. This review was very, very helpful for me in particular because tomorrow's going to be Monday. Back at work from vacation. I could use a smiley face. AJ from MA says, still perfect after all these years. I've been listening to this podcast ever since I moved and started a new job with a very long commute. I love keeping up with new releases, and I enjoy hearing the arbiters of Fighting in the War Room critique all things entertainment. Worth a listen if you were stuck in traffic or while you unwind with some tea. Keep it up. P.S. I got here from Joe Rogan's podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience.
That is not.
I'm kidding. AJ from MA, just for everyone listening, I would not want to implicate them listening to the Joe Rogan podcast. That was my editorial injection.
It's not AJ from MAGA.
That's right.
Hey.
Oh, clever. Very clever. Patches on fire over here. Thank you for the review. Very helpful. Also, you mentioned tea. Today was my first day. We're in the middle of August where I started having fond flash forwards, if you want to go back to Lost, of tea season, which is right around the corner. I can't wait. It always comes
right
after
the hockey
season.
Is this segment 8,000 minutes long? Yes. Hurry up.
David is finally. Mr. Autumn Man morphing up.
Finally. Rico, 1992, our last and longest review for this week, says, answering Patch's question on 268. Ooh, we're getting into the fighting in the war
this is,
lore
this
here.
Like,
that sounds like last week's episode.
Okay, I haven't listened to it. Why would I? Childish Gambino has two songs and videos in 2018 that address serious issues. Oh. This is America, maybe, about how we are desensitized to violence. It feels like summer videos about how climate change is happening, whether or not we choose to discuss it. Hence all the rapper cameos in the video. Someone will have to explain to me, this is David talking now, what the abundance of rappers has to do with the existence of climate change, but maybe I missed something in the segment. But those are both violence and climate change, massive issues that are too large for a single piece of media to adequately cover. First Reformed is about a preacher learning about climate change and its effects on the community. I love all four of the hosts. Oh, okay. We've swerved here. Dave Seven and I both have affection for world building and movies. Katie is a great moderator and adds a much needed feminine touch to the movie podcast world. Not a lot of moms on movie podcasts. I can't really get a reading on Patch's interests, which keeps me captivated with his takes. And David, autocorrect won't let me type the last name. Autocorrect won't even let him type the last name. It's just shutting
down. Yeah, autocorrect knows the
stop.
Just deleting it. Wow, that's anti-Semitic. You give excellent recommendations for media I wouldn't otherwise watch or have heard about. You're the cool older brother, I'm old, who is a little above the fray when it comes to mainstream film discussion. The internet is already full of Marvel quick takes and not enough love for Paddington. Amen. Keep doing your thing, War Roomies. Was this review helpful? In many ways, particularly including me into what happened on this show while I was gone. Thank you all so much for listening and for writing reviews. Please continue to do so if you haven't already. We'll be sure to read it on the show.
If you guys write enough reviews in 1 week, the whole show will just be David reading and reacting to reviews.
You write enough reviews.
Leave us reviews, right?
Rocco's Modern Life has a Netflix revival special called Static Shock.
No, it's not. Reasons. It's called Static Cling.
Static Cling.
Static Cling.
Wow. Confidence.
People look to us as authorities, Dave.
Jesus. Well, it's a pleasurable series that title didn't make sense to me until I finished the episode, because what I was mostly psyched about was the return of this 90s Nickelodeon cartoon that always had like a unique voice. It was from my childhood, and I was interested to see, of the many reboots of things from my childhood now, what was this one going to offer? So Rocco, Heifer, and Filbert have been in space for the past 20 years watching the same rerun of their favorite cartoon, The Fatheads, which you might remember from the series if you watch Rocco's Modern Life. But if not, just think about it. It's their favorite TV show from 20 years ago when they got blasted into space. They land back in their hometown of O-Town in the current day and have to adapt to the current time period, changes in technology and things like that. And Rocco doesn't handle it so well, and for comfort decides to look to nostalgia and try to reboot the Fatheads series so that he could have something that makes him feel like maybe the change isn't so bad. And so that's the plot of this svelte 40-minute television special. Patches, you were the one who suggested we all watch it. I knew that it was coming out because the Invader Zim movie's also coming out this week, so it's odd to see, or I guess it's a special.
Also getting dumped on Netflix after Nickelodeon decided not to air it, which is what happened with the Rocko's Modern Life special, and maybe we can litigate that. Well, we don't have the facts, but we could be angry at Nickelodeon for not airing this on actual television. But yes.
Yeah. I mean, should we be? Because it's going to be just as visible on Netflix, isn't it?
Maybe.
I guess. I think that Nickelodeon's audience is in the end of the day, a different audience than just Netflix. And putting it on Netflix is a true nostalgia play. It's not for kids. And I think if it was on Nickelodeon, kids and parents could potentially watch it together.
It is. And I watched it in the, because our Netflix, we have the child filter one for Charlie, and I watched it under his account. So it is made available to kids under the kid filter.
Interesting.
It is. My wife and I sat down to watch it, and before it started, she's like, "Oh, Rocko's Modern Life." I remember that show being so gross, and I was I don't know what you're talking about. That doesn't sound right. I remember Heifer just being like, "I died once in the middle of a lull," which always killed me. But then the show started, the new one, and it is disgusting.
It's disgusting.
it's
awesome.
Disgusting.
It's profoundly gross. I mean, there's a character who collects boogers in a jar. That's the most 90s thing that could happen. I just feel like there's nothing for kids or adults today that is this gross, because they don't make Jackass anymore. Rocko's Modern Life is the grossest thing on the planet. It's disgusting. But I could not believe, and maybe I was just still in rant mode after last week's episode, which David did not listen to, but, you know, being kind of upset that nothing mainstream and nothing aimed at masses can deal with important issues and still entertain. I got to watch Rocko's Modern Life Static Kling and just be, it's so heartwarming and it's so sharp and no bullshit when it comes to interrogating all this crap that builds up in society today, from fans being angry over rebooted properties not being the same, something we hear online in our pop culture quarter of the universe all the fucking time, to this really sweet, low-key story about a transgender daughter and the father trying to make sense of it all. Change, change, change. This whole special takes the 20 years that have passed from the original series ending and bringing it back, and uses that to propel the story forward and say something about what it means for time to actually change. I mean, they actually animate the winds of change in Static Kling, which I think is really goofy and fun and, again, kind of profound. I was really moved by Rocko's Modern Life Static Kling while also feeling a little indulgent. It got my nostalgia, tickled my nostalgia funny bone, I guess, a little bit. But I think Joe Murray, who created the show, who has gone on to do some other animated series over the years, maybe nothing as gross and teetering on the edge of kid and adult entertainment, took his responsibility as this kind of like white 58-year-old man, according to his Wikipedia page, and told a really interesting story that most of his contemporaries would not. And perhaps that's why it's not on Nickelodeon.
I mean, I think because it deals with that and it's framed the way it is, it justifies its own existence, which is something that a lot of, you know, reboots don't do. By having something to say about what it is in its world, it also is functioning as a whole bunch of callbacks to stuff that appeared in the episode. It's interesting because I didn't really find it that gross, because it's such a period of time in, like, early 90s children's animation, where we're like right on the border of a lot of computer assisted stuff, where it's like this and Ren and Stimpy. Like, Doug was the outlier in terms of the way characters were designed, and even that had, like, you know, purple and pink people. But, like, even the Rugrats was, you know, kind of considered, like, an ugly design at the time, and then, like, Ren and Stimpy, and then, like, this was like a step down from the grossness of Ren and Stimpy. And I was surprised how well this stays on model while still, like, updating. It looks like it's all still hand-drawn, because there are, you know, like, incompleted lines and things like that that wouldn't happen if you were building the characters.
They also
and, like,
come
sort of
for 3D animation in a vicious way.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I had to believe,
yes,
David was just giddy over, I hope. But that,
I don't know. I don't think David got to that part.
I bailed after 20 minutes.
Yeah, you missed the part where they reproduce some truly hideous 3D animation.
Yes.
Oh, great. I mean,
it's still gross, though. Like, it's gross because there's boogers, and, like, when people get, like, people have, like, fart clouds, and, like, it's gross.
Me bailing was not, I just want to clear the air that me bailing was not a dismissal of the show. I loved Rocko's Modern Life growing up. I could have happily weathered another 20 minutes of this. It was just, we just sat down to watch it in the middle of dinner, And, you know, it was...
You were like, nope.
It was enough at the time.
I remember being in the target audience and this didn't read as gross. Like, this is the level of gross that's funny, I guess, is what it still reads to as me as more like an animation curio. Like, it's interesting that we don't have animation that gross anymore, because I definitely think there's like an attractiveness to it. I don't know. There's some things like...
Well, I love how not unsterilized it is compared to all the animation that is really geared towards children these days. I mean, I do appreciate it on that level, at the very least.
Really early on, after they've reintroduced Mr. Big Head, he plays an entire scene where he's laying face up, but his neck turns around and faces like the other person. He's at the same height as Rocco, which is both on model, but also like something that cartoons don't do anymore. Like, we don't play with, I mean, I sometimes like Adventure Time does because, or did because it was like part of its actual, you know, story and fantastical settings. But in terms of, the era where we were hand drawing things, so it was just as easy to make like, somebody's eyes come out of their mouth when they're like super surprised as it was to, you know, draw them just looking surprised. I feel like when we move into like 3D or computer assisted animation, we lose a lot of these like grosser themes and poses because we're dealing with, I don't know, models and things that aren't going to be like easily altered if you want to do something really extreme with like a reaction shot or somebody getting punched in the face or really early on in Rocco's modern life nipples.
Very
expressive nipples.
Really expressive.
First 30 seconds, there's some serious nipple action.
Wow, yeah, I forgot about that.
But yeah, I really enjoyed how much it looked while I was going through it, and I'll probably return to some of that just to see how it manages to feel very 90s while, you know, realizing that that's part of its charm. I don't know. Good Rocco's Modern Life in terms of a show that wasn't necessarily known for doing a lot of meta stuff to sort of commit to that and execute it so well.
Here's what makes me nervous about this, and I don't have like all of the context, but I just feel like any time that you acknowledge fans within the art, it gives them what they want and empowers them to be awful. Thinking specifically of the Rick and Morty Szechuan sauce thing, which like I know about it primarily through Dave. And if this leads to more Rocco's Modern Life on Nickelodeon or Netflix or whatever, is that going to just completely diminish the point of this, which is to say, stop clinging to things from your past and let change happen?
I can't imagine there will be more. I will say that. And if there is, I mean, Rocco has grown up in this, right? Like, this might be the vehicle for making that statement, but if there was more, wouldn't it? I don't know. Is that, Dave, what do you think? I have absolutely no idea. I want more of this. That's the sad thing. I finished it with my wife and I just like, I thought it was so well done and such an alternative to everything, even all the Adult Swim and Cartoon Network stuff that is really valuable and heartwarming and digging into kind of societal issues, with these beautiful illustrations. Like, it just still feels like such an alternative because it's true cartooning. As you said, Dave, maybe Adventure Time gets to a scene similar to where like Rocco's entire skin can be stripped down to a skeleton. or, you know, that for me, very memorable image from the intro where Rocco gets squished and his brain matter pops out of his head and his dog starts eating it. Like, that stuff is just
so gross.
You don't see it. And they're able to connect the dot. And even like the character designs are just so gross. Like Heifer's dead dad, who's a wolf and blind. It's just like, it's so absurd. Yeah. It's so cartoonish. We don't get that. And so I'd want more, but you're right, Katie. I mean, if they did do more, I guess it's against message. Like, we're not supposed to have more Rocco. And I don't know. The end of this is all about how everyone's really happy with the new Big Heads. They kind of get into spoiler territory. I don't think that we can really spoil this. Or Fat Heads.
Yeah, how dare you spoil this cartoon?
Sorry. I'm going to minorly spoil the ending. So they make the new Fat Heads cartoon. And to do it, Mr. Big... Oh, God. Now I'm Big Head.
Fatheads is the cartoon. Yeah.
Fatheads is the cartoon. Rachel Bighead is Mr. Bighead's transgender daughter, and she decides, because she loves her family, to make this new cartoon. And everyone the world over loves it. And Rocco is the one who's pissed off, right? It's actually different because she's added a baby and there's now a family dimension. And everyone loves it and she doesn't. So it's not that the winds of change, as the special goes, suggests that we could get more of something old, as long as it's new and as long as it's reacting to the world around us and not crystallizing as the old thing that we remember. This is what the Star Wars fans get pissed off about. We should get new Star Wars. There's new Star Wars stories to tell with the right creators who are responding to the world around them and making new Star Wars for a good reason. The bad thing to do is just make more old shit because the fans will pay for it. The good thing to do is make more Rocko's Modern Life if Rocko's Modern Life can tell stories about the world we live in today and not 20 years ago.
Yeah, this feels like me and my rant about like Amblin-inspired movie posters or anything that's like doing 80s nostalgia, or just like make your own shit. And I feel like this show agrees with me.
I think it has some advantages being an animated show, because basically if you want to bring an animated show back, it's like, do you have the creative team that's willing to do it and can they execute it? And I think this shows that they can if they want to, and it's not going to feel weird. Like, you know, I don't know if I want a Community movie anymore. I guess it'd be interesting. But like that sort of weird continuation feels like a not marketable cash grab. But who knows with Netflix?
Anything's possible, like watching all 7 seasons of Mad Men again, which is partially
what we weren't talking about Mad Men.
Listen, we're always talking about Mad Men. Sometimes it's just subtext.
All right, for this week's mini segment, we're going to talk about a little documentary that's coming out this week that I think all fans of true crime podcasts should check out. It's not
a
Netflix mini series.
Can I do you one better? Well, you already tried to stop me from making this connection before we were recording.
You didn't even let him finish a sentence.
Please. I've been champing at the bit.
Why would I intro the segment?
Make this connection. Since the beginning of time, the Pat just keeps hammering on the true crime thing, but I feel like the movie plays
I haven't
more.
Even named the movie. I haven't even named the movie yet.
Okay,
it's Cold Case Hammarskjöld.
Cold Case Hammarskjöld.
I love the movie, and all I want to do is tell the true crime fans out there, hashtag fans, that they need to see this movie. But I can't even say the title. That's
okay,
the real
but I don't want you to address the true crime fans. That's now that you've said Cold Case Hammarskjöld. I'm about to solve the mystery of what I want
you to
address.
You haven't even said what it's about.
I think that
who's on first?
I think that this movie is geared for people who love a television show called Lost, and that it has far more in common with the plot mechanics of something like Lost than it does with your average true crime genre, even though it plays in the world of true crime much more so than it does in a fictional universe created by J.J.
Well, maybe you should explain that point after I introduce the film.
Much because like
I'm,
the film
I'm
Cold Case Hammarskjöld, we are starting very far from where we are ending up and in no discernible order.
I'm interested in what that means in the context of the film. Which goes a little like this. So basically, Cold Case Hammarskjöld, it premiered at Sundance, and I didn't catch it there, actually. I had to watch it this week, but people were just like, it's twisty, it's turny, and it is. So we won't give too much away about where things go. But this Danish filmmaker, Mads Brügger, who has made some he's involved with his own films. He's on camera. He is poking people. He's provocative. He made a film called The Ambassador eons ago now. I guess that was like 2011. But he is back and very curious about the death of someone most of our listeners are probably not too familiar with, UN General Secretary Dag Hammarskjöld, who
one of our listeners is very familiar, though. Can you explain who that is?
Yes, my father knew who Dag Hammarskjöld was. And all you need to know really about Dag Hammarskjöld is that he was the UN General Secretary, which meant he ruled, he could actually deploy troops. I need to learn more about the UN's history, to be quite honest. I know that the UN has troops, but how they govern and how they operate, big mystery to me. I'm going to fall into a Wikipedia rabbit hole soon. But anyway, Dag Hammarskjöld crashed in an airplane in northern Rhodesia in 1961. And it was ruled a pilot error. Like, there was just, you know, the plane went down, he died. And a lot of people have, you know, thinky face emoji over this, over the years. And for good reason. I mean, almost immediately, Mads Brügger poking around, wondering what really happened with this plane crash because of the geopolitical landscape, what was happening in Africa at that time. It's clear that there may have been some funny business in the death of Dag Hammarskjöld. And as he starts peeling back the layers, he's both playing with the form of documentary. He's hired two kind of secretaries to take down his notes in real time. He's basically outlining the film as we watch the film, which is an interesting way of kind of breaking the documentary form in half while also being very straightforward in telling this story piece by piece. And then, you know, being true crimey about it, talking to witnesses 40, 50 years later, or whatever, and looking at old paperwork that's come from the desk of different African nationals. You know, what really happened to Dag Hammarskjöld? And my God, like halfway through this film, even Mads Brügger is like, I have no fucking clue where this is going. I didn't know when I started. I didn't even know who Dag Hammarskjöld really was. I didn't really care. And I know no one else cares. And I'm still going to just keep digging anyway, because I've been doing it for 6 years and maybe we'll find an answer. And then he stumbles upon a huge, like, well, it gets really crazy. And again, to not be spoilery about it, it feels like Scientology-esque at times, what's lurking under the surface here. It's definitely government conspiracies and some astonishing, if true, you know, revelations that really put into question, like, is a documentary a piece of thorough journalism, or can it just be an explosive ripping the can of worms open and putting something out there for people to definitely need to source more? And definitely, you know, he has a single source who kind of blows this whole movie up, and it is jaw-dropping. And now, why is it like Lost, David, to quickly wrap up with Cold Case Hammarskjöld?
To quickly wrap up?
To quickly wrap up.
I mean, this is not a movie that quickly wraps up anything. But I do think that the nature of not only the mysteries that he uncovers, but also how he goes about cutting together do feel to me like they are trying to reverse engineer them to a Lost-like story. And what he gets into and its implications about subjects as far-reaching as white supremacy, which is really where the movie drifts without giving anything away, are shocking and potentially illuminating in their own sort of tainted way, and sort of, you know, a conspiracy theorist wet dream. There's blood and dirt under every surface that he looks at. I do sometimes feel like his whole shtick gets in the way of, like, if the story is as monumental,
right? He's cheeky.
The way this movie ends suggests that he has basically tapped into one of the biggest stories in the last 150 years of human history. And for him to unpack that in this way, like, once he arrived at that, you know, thread or truth or whatever you want to call it that he arrives at, I would think the logical thing to do would be to essentially start a new movie where you have that endpoint in mind, and you sort of reverse engineer a movie from there, trying to contextualize this. I mean, that's not the business Mads Brügger is in. I don't want this to be an Alex Gibney movie. I respect.
But that's why this feels more like Serial to me, right? Like, let's kind of go on this kind of rambling odyssey.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely the incredible irresponsibility that Sarah Koenig brought to Serial, of just like playing with people's lives and figuring it out on air as she mucks about. And that is part and parcel of what Mads Brugger is doing. I do think the chase is definitely a part of the fun here. This is a movie that, as insane as its conclusions are, really is about the process of reaching them, and that does sort of justify the means of getting there. It does get a little shticky. I mean, like, the shtick wears just because of the gravity of what he finds. But it is an absolutely fascinating film. It does feel to me, in at least the first couple seasons of Lost. I mean, I'm not talking about time travel and shit, but like everything about Hydra and the
David sees
the
a plane
project
crash
and
he's like, it's lost.
Well, it's funny. I wasn't even thinking about the plane crash when I was shoving this down your throat as a reference point. And then you said it starts with the plane crash. And I was like, maybe that is where it started in my head. But it is a fascinating movie. I think Dave Gonzalez, for many reasons, Lost being just one of them, is probably its target audience. I'd be really interested to hear what he has to say about it when he sees it.
Dave, are you going to watch this movie?
Oh, yeah, probably. It sounds like it's up my alley, although it's, because of two things. One, I was very into the podcast Up and Vanish the first season when it was happening, where they actually ended up bringing that podcast to a close as an arrest was made in this cold case, this Georgian cold case. And then I just finished a book a couple weeks ago called Chaos, like Charles Manson, The Secret History of the 60s. It was a journalist who was hired to do a Premiere magazine story in like 1999.
Oh, yeah, it's Tom O'Neill who runs Gold Derby now.
Exactly. And so he's like, yeah, it's his down the rabbit hole of like this magazine story turning into this book. And he falls down a similar rabbit hole where, you know, maybe the CIA was working on mind control experiments very near where the family is. So an interesting thing. I want to see how the movie, the shtick, as you guys are calling it, is like, I want to see how much the movie has to say about the hobby of like true criming, because it seems like picking up a true crime and following it down the hole is a documentary trope now, like a way in documentary.
Yeah. But it's not even, a documentary filmmaking trope, I feel like. We don't see it that much. I feel like most of the films that we see are pretty sturdy, and
it is a little Richard Simmons like Lost in His House. It is the podcast model of like, let's find out together while actual responsibility for what these what this process might reveal. But at the beginning of the movie, Mads Brugger says that what we're about to see, this process he's about to undergo, will be the world's biggest murder mystery or the world's most idiotic murder mystery. And I think it could probably be construed as a credit to the movie that by the time it's over, you're still not entirely sure which one it is, but it definitely seems like it could be both.
Yeah.
So it's Cold Case Hammarskjöld. It's out in New York and LA, and I don't know where else. I guess this coming Friday.
New York and LA this Friday, and probably expanding and coming to a streaming service near you eventually. So check it out.
I would imagine.
Google it.
Yeah, I would imagine they put some, if it connects at all, that they try to make it an Oscar thing.
Could you spell that last part of the title?
Cold Case, Hammarskjöld, with an umlaut, LD.
You know.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll Google it, and so should you.
It's a typical story where the bassist kills the singer, the guitarist and the drummer find they're in love with each other. It's the story of the kid who clearly won't know what to say when the love of his life starts to calmly walk away. And it's the story of the dad.
Before we start, we're going to talk about Universal deciding to scrap the release of The Hunt. So for anyone who doesn't like listening to us talk about politics, I feel like it's been a while, honestly. So you guys have been spared so much.
Last week? I guess some stuff leaked.
We haven't said Donald Trump's name in a while, so that's been nice. But
I definitely said it last week. I apologize.
Well, anyway, so we got to talk about,
we're gonna Beetlejuice him. Here we go.
We got to talk about this fucking guy because on Friday he was on his way somewhere and talked to the press, and basically someone asking him if he's racist, which has been a topic of debate for obvious reasons in the last week. He said no, Hollywood is the one who are racist, and he followed it up with a tweet. And for many of us, I think we sat there saying, huh, why, what is he talking about? What movie did he see? I made a Green Book joke on Twitter. And then after Googling around for a little bit, because I was working with one of our writers to try to write about it, I pinpointed that there had been a repeated conservative media and Fox News talking point over the last week about The Hunt, the movie coming out from that was supposed to come out from Universal in September, that is ostensibly, according to this conservative conspiracy theory, about liberals hunting deplorables, a most dangerous game style. That was the story that was out there about it. As far as I could tell, no one was ever writing about who had actually seen it. I'm not sure anyone outside of Universal and the filmmakers actually saw it. And so Trump got wind of that and tweeted about how Hollywood is the real racist. They had already suspended the advertising campaign for this movie in the wake of the two mass shootings, because it is a movie about people hunting each other with guns. And then on Saturday, they announced that they were canceling the release. Not really saying it was because the president tweeted about it, but it seemed... even if they didn't do it because the president tweeted about it, it allows the president a very big victory of tweeting and getting a movie to a studio to back down their movie release. So it puts all of us in the unenviable position of having to defend a horror movie that none of us have seen and may or may not have actually been any good against the president. And it sucks. It just sucks.
Can we just pause for a brief moment of silence in memoriam of how stupid our entire world is?
This whole thing is so stupid. I know that there have been other like movies that have become a whole drama
That's fine.
Sorry. Pause.
My moment of silence.
I mean, we've been kind of like a nonstop moment of silence pause for stupidity. What's funny is that this filmmaker, Craig Zobel, was in not quite such a dramatic situation, but his movie Compliance, that was at Sundance a while ago, featured really interesting, like, morally complex situations and was willfully misread by a lot of people and got him into hot water. So, poor dude, he's been down this road before.
But this is...
Wait, is Compliance the phone call guy at the fast food place?
Although I would stress that, as far as I'm concerned anyway, the movie itself is really a red herring here. And not the story. I think like the nature of The Hunt, what it's about, its quality, anything like that is.
Why are you talking around it? What is the quality?
Essentially irrelevant.
What is the reporting on the movie?
What do you know about the movie?
THR reported on what the plot.
Why is The Hunt any different from, say, Ready or Not, which comes out in 2 weeks, which features a bride being hunted by a whole bunch of aristocrats?
This is a leading question just to set up the plot of the film?
Yes, that would
just
be
to right. Understand where we are. Okay.
It's a little podcast maneuver. It's a classic move from our seasoned vets.
I like to thwart it by calling out exactly what
you're the improv class guy who says no.
See, what we do is we tell the people what the movie is about, and then we talk about the movie.
Right.
Uh-huh. And then, here we go. Anyway, and then we explain why it should appeal to fans of Lost.
So The Hunt is about the cast of Fighting in the War Room.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, the Hunt is a movie about, and this is again, you know, and when I say it's a movie about, I mean the way that it's been positioned in the trailers that we've seen, because that's really anything that anyone in the public sphere knows about the movie, is about a group of elites hunting a less affluent group of people who are referred to in the trailer as deplorables, who are these regular American citizens.
So they are referred to in the play. I thought deplorables was something that came out of nowhere. I hadn't watched the trailer.
I believe, and I'm not into, I wouldn't say this on television, but on podcasts, whatever. Sarah Koenig could chase a murderer up her own ass. There are no rules. I believe that they do use the word deplorables. And so the idea was that this is a movie about liberals hunting conservatives, even though elites is a bit of conservative rhetoric in and of itself. But I find it hard to believe that Craig Zobel and Blumhouse, who's been behind some of these socially conscious horror films of recent years, would put their time and energy behind a movie where that is ultimately the premise is no more complicated than that. It's written by Damon Lindelof, or co-written anyway. It stars Betty Gilpin.
It is about Lost.
Everything it is about Lost. It stars Betty Gilpin, star of Glow, who is a very smart woman, and you can code that however you like. But I don't think she is going to be in a movie that is really as simple as
also like what no studio that wants to make money is going to make a movie like this. Like, you're trying to appeal to as wide a range of people as possible. Right. Like, what is the point? Like, it's a bad idea for a movie, and it's going to alienate anyone who wants to see it.
This movie is produced by Blumhouse, Jason Blum, who produced all of the Purge movies, and I don't know if the Purge movies fits that understanding of like four quadrantness that you're depicting here.
They made a lot of money, including presumably from conservative people. So, like, why would they not want to appeal to at least those people?
I mean, because they work on different levels, right? The Purge could easily be a movie where you're just seeing people outrun people with big knives. But at the end of a Purge movie, if it's a bunch of rich white people hunting black people, I mean, that's making a huge political statement, whether it's kind of blunt and
does that
obvious.
Happen in a Purge movie?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
I haven't seen a Purge movie.
Anyway, mainstream pop cinema with social undercurrents should not be something that becomes too risky for a major studio to explore. But it's like
the perfect sequel to our segment last week, where I was begging a studio to make something of social.
We were sleeping on the hunt.
Levels. I know. Yeah. I forgot about the hunt.
Universe is there with your wishes. But I do feel like the idea of what the movie is about, it's very obvious on the surface what Trump thinks it's about, what Fox and Friends, where he gets all of his information, you know, thinks it's about. It is not nearly as interesting to me as a talking point as how this all happened and what it portends for the future. Maybe because like we now live in a world where effectively theaters were in the studios are scared because like when they pulled the interview from the theaters, it was because they were afraid of people bringing violence to the movie theaters. And Universal, that was the movie theater's decision, the theater chains. Now we have Universal making the decision on behalf of the theaters because the theaters are probably, you know, it's not that people would stay away from the movie necessarily so much as that theaters would get skittish about violence happening there. It's certainly happened before. Universal knows that firsthand. They released Trainwreck, which is a movie that during its opening weekend was playing during a mass shooting in Louisiana or Alabama.
I think it was Louisiana.
Yeah. But so what we have here now, though, is the fear that the president's political supporters are so violent that we can't safely enjoy art in a public space because of the president who is responsible for canceling this movie. The president of the United States. It's his base that has become so violent that they can't risk releasing something that might agitate them.
Well, now, hold on. I don't want to defend that too much because we're slightly on the same wavelength, but I mean, there was this whole mass shooting incident. Like, you can understand why they'd pause on this on some.
It did seem like they had it from two fronts. Like, there was a reason to do it, to pause the advertising before Trump got involved. And then when that happened, it was like, All signs were pointing to this is more trouble than it's worth. To them.
Not that there's ever a good time to release a movie about shooting
in
America.
So it's not like it's not like when after 9/11 they delayed a couple of movies that had reference to a lot of violence or terrorism or even had they edited out shots of the World Trade Center. That is not something that is going to happen again. There will be other instances of terrorism, but there wasn't the risk that 6 months down the line the two towers were going to be attacked again. In this case, waiting for there to be a clear stretch with no mass shooting in the United States of America, you're going to be waiting a really fucking long time. And that's why when this news came out, you know, my tweet was something to the effect of like, you know, when America feels too ugly to look at itself, it just breaks the nearest mirror because, you know, rather than the concern here being like, well, why don't we get to the root of the problem and prevent mass shootings from happening? It's why don't we take video game displays out of Walmart while Walmart is still allowed to sell fucking guns? It doesn't make any goddamn sense. And this feels like the next step from that. And that's why I feel like Universal made a mistake. I think, you know, the sensitivity of releasing, if there was a mass shooting, which there probably will be the weekend that, whatever weekend, of pulling the marketing or delaying the movie a couple of weeks, that's one thing. But canceling it entirely for the foreseeable future with no words about postponing it or anything like that feels like a real cowardly concession.
Dave, was this a real cowardly concession?
I mean, it's weird that it's like government censorship without anybody having to say anything. That's the weirdest thing to me, or at least publicly. Because, you know, this one might have an argument made towards it, but really the reality is this Fox News could have picked anything, and that the president saw it at the right time and was forced to flea flick an answer off to media, then it could have been any movie. Probably, you know, could be in the future another one now that, you know, he's fucking taste for it.
Get him to tweet about cats.
I mean, hopefully it doesn't get that weird before we acknowledge it as bad. I really hope the hunt doesn't go away. I hope it resurfaces somewhere, because outright cancellation feels like censorship. And like everybody else is saying, having not seen it, I could see why it's not the type of movie that you want to release into theaters at this given point. But there's tons of other ways of distribution. I think it's really dumb to declare it like basically a waste of money. What it takes for a company to write off a whole movie like that in terms of a way a business thinks means that they're really scared of it in a way that is disconcerting to me, because I don't think the government thinking that movies are good or bad before they see them should have any influence on whether or not those movies get released, period. I think that's a weird level of censorship, because we aren't talking about we're talking about content censorship sight unseen, which is gross, and you know, a step on the way to mind crime if you want to be really conspiratorial about it.
Don't you assume they also, like, in talking about the money loss, like, it was opening a week after It Chapter 2, like, it didn't seem like they were positioning it to make a ton of money anyway. And they had already, like, lost the money by, like, pulling all their advertising that presumably was already paid for. Like, I don't know that, like, the fact that they chose to pull it, like, and the money that they will lose says as much about how afraid they were of it as much as being like, oh, this is just throwing more good money after bad. It's not worth the trouble.
Yeah, and it seems weird because, like, even something like Slender Man, which was a horrible movie and went through a whole bunch of legal things where basically people were like, don't release this fucking movie. They cut it to shit. They still released it and just, like, dumped it into nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure it did, you know, fine considering how much scandal it went through. But it seems odd to, like I was setting David up beforehand, it seems odd to have something like Ready or Not that's, like, coming out in two weeks, and it seems like it's going to go forward. I saw a trailer for it today in front of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. So, yeah, that's hunting people with guns. People get shot in that trailer multiple times.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see where the line was drawn and that Universal kind of balked in this one.
Shooting cast members of the OC is okay, but shooting conservatives is not.
I mean, yeah, I think the twist thing about this is, I mean, they made this movie in the wake of many, many, many horrific mass shootings. So,
but
why
don't you feel
pull
like, I mean,
on that
I was
basis?
I wanted to ask, like, what we think the twist of the hunt is. Like, what do we think it is actually about? And, like, if the movie itself is not a critique of violence, I would be stunned. Like, that's, you know, the idea that, like, violence in society is a reason not to make a movie that is, you know, critical of that violence is,
well,
stupid to me.
I mean, based on the Hollywood Reporter's, like, read on the script, you know, everyone on Fox and Friends has it backwards, right? The deplorables, quote unquote,
are the heroes,
right?
Yeah.
That the liberal elites are the ones, like, use backwards logic, and it's funny. We'll never know. I mean, maybe it'll pop up on Netflix.
We'll know.
Like, the interview.
Yeah,
this movie will definitely see the light of day.
I just don't know when. Anticipate it. I got this story came into my purview at the same time as another really more sensitive, more compelling, more fascinating story that I would point people to check out. There's a lot of good writing on it. Our pal Oliver wrote something at Vulture, and there's a good piece on BuzzFeed. David probably maybe knows about this saga too,
yes,
about this film Adam that played at Sundance. This is a total left field kind of departure from what we're talking about, but
it's not. It's smart. It's a good connection. Keep going.
But so Adam is an adaptation of a kind of notorious book. A lot of people do not care for the Adam novel, which deals with LGBTQ relationships and has a transgender kind of character at the heart of it who falls in love with a cisgendered white kid.
No, it's a lesbian who falls in love with
a cisgender white kid,
but she thinks that he's trans.
Yes, sorry. See, I'm getting my wires crossed, because I don't want to delve too much into this because I have not seen Adam yet. But yeah, there's a lot going on in the like summer relationships pool that they all find themselves in New York. It's a coming of age film. And again, I've only read all these kind of like long reported features about the film. But basically there's a lot of controversy over depicting that, right? That there's like the miscommunication over a character who is not trans, who appears to be trans, and how that leans into horrible stereotypes. And then there's a whole saga about the making of Adam. It's an indie film that shot New York that apparently mistreated, extras who were in the film who did not realize that they were in a movie version of Adam and like what they would be playing in the film. There's so much controversy that is really hard to parse, especially when you're like me, totally removed from it and trying to be empathetic and really understand what's going on. But at the heart of it is people, and this, the BuzzFeed story on Adam is called "People Are Calling for This Queer Indie Film to Be Canceled Before It Hits Theaters." And I feel like we're seeing that more and more, and it's interesting to see the hunt get pulled from the far right and that backlash, and then see Adam kind of in this maelstrom of left or at least progressive thinking, and kind of the same rhetoric coming after it before it comes out in theaters. Yeah, I just find that fascinating and worrisome on all levels for when we talk about art. And I know I'm trying to be as sensitive as I possibly can when I read these stories about the Adam film. But I can't help but wonder if this film could just come out and then the conversations could start, even if they're coming after the filmmakers for something horrible. And have those stories be told. That's important. But can these films just come out first? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I just because I think it needs to be said. I mean, there's no use conflating Donald Trump with the people who are trying
absolutely
to cancel
not.
Adam. They're coming at it from very different things, from very different perspectives, and with different agendas.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I think your point about engaging with the actual art before it is decried is a valid one, even though Donald Trump, unlike people throughout history who have been talking about most other movies, doesn't really give a shit about art or anything like that.
Certainly not, but there are definitely conservative voices who – this would be a great opportunity for good conservative criticism for people who are still on that side of the line to write something thoughtful about art.
All of the good conservative criticism must have been lost with all the good conservative stand-up comics somewhere, or the good conservative art of any kind. I wouldn't hold your breath.
I guess, my point here is that this is what criticism is about. This is why we talk about movies, and they should get out there no matter how controversial they are at times. I really don't think there's anything that can offend someone so badly. I mean, also Trump loves what's his name? Does all the Obama documentaries. Like,
oh, Dinesh D'Souza. Yeah,
you can love Dinesh D'Souza, but you are taking down the hunt for being racist. I mean, my God.
This is, well, not the hunt for being racist. This is someone who did accuse Black-ish of being racist because ABC wouldn't make White-ish. I mean, this is someone who, I can't remember if he tweeted about Get Out. I'm sure if he did, it was to call it racist. This is, you know, this is not someone who gives a shit about art or what it's trying to do. It's,
well, here's the thing, is like,
it's a battering ram.
Do you think that if you had said the name The Hunt to Trump at any point before he said this, he would have been like, oh yeah, that rings a bell. He just like repeated a vaguely heard talking point from Fox News.
If you asked Trump what the name of the movie was today, he wouldn't be able to tell you.
Yeah, probably.
But now here's the thing, and this is extrapolating a ton, but I just want to throw up a flag on this whole incident because I don't want progressive-minded people who are mad at Trump for tweeting this and mad at Universal for potentially, you know, enacting censorship on some level here. But if this movie had come out and been about like deplorables rising up and beating liberal elites, like I can imagine a certain level of liberal outrage. And that's where I get worried that it's all starting to sound similar.
I doubt that's what the movie is about either.
I don't know. I'm just like, I worry about people jumping on all this stuff from all sides of the line. Like, we're not, people aren't all the same. I'm not making that claim at all, but I'm like, when
you wonder why movies aren't political anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
If it came out and people were mad at it, that would be super valid because it came out and then people saw it and got mad at it.
Absolutely.
So, like, that would be a much better situation than the one we find ourselves in right now. And, like, some liberals could have gotten mad. I don't want to discourage yelling at the monolith. Like, the audience isn't at fault here. What's at fault is, like, a studio that got scared by the fucking president.
Right. I mean, listen, again, I don't really care about the particulars of the movie nearly as much as I do its fate and how it's been treated. But, you know, it's not accurate to say that movies aren't political anymore. I think movies are political as ever. It's just that this is such an explicit premise. But to go back to our previous segment, I mean, Cold Case Hammarskjöld is a very political movie, and not only because it's about a dead politician, but I think it's very much about the sort of white nationalism that Donald Trump is propagating. It is a giant fuck you to anyone who thinks like that, while also being deeply afraid of them. And it will never, ever, ever come across Trump's radar, you know, beyond the fact that I'm sure he's personal friends with all the white nationalists in the movie. But like it's just too oblique for him. It's not something that's on the radar of Fox and Friends. I think Parasite, which won the Palme d'Or, is a very political movie. Synonyms, which won the Golden Bear at Berlin, is an incredibly political movie.
These are not movies that are huge.
Right. I mean, like High Flying Bird on Netflix is another great political movie. I mean, these are A Hidden Life by Terrence. I mean, I can go on, but Transit. I'm just going to name all the good movies from this year. But there are, Transit has come out, as is High Flying Bird. But, the fact remains that it was just that, I think to go back to something Patches said, I think it was Patches, who was just like, this movie, because it's so on its sleeve about its premise, just happened to catch Fox News' attention, and that whiff was all it took to get to Donald Trump and so on. But I think that, we are seeing as active and exciting and vital a political cinema as we would hope to in a time like this. It's just not hitting the kind of nerve that, fucking subhuman.
I mean, that's the problem.
Fox
I mean, your definition
study.
Of what film is doing is not the same as what the definition of what film is doing for the mainstream.
But and film isn't doing anything for those people. Like, this is like they don't have a real relationship with film. People,
I think
Fox
Patches is talking about people in the mainstream who might be attentive to these ideas but don't know that they're there and aren't seeking them out.
Okay.
Because they can't find these movies that are tiny or buried on Netflix. You know, they have to see, they have to get a political provocation out of The Hunt that when it's released in 3,500 theaters or would have been. And that's,
well, it is why something like Get Out was such a phenomenon, because it was so in the mainstream.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't help but think that this is what was an opportunity for like the rare conservative critic to come out and write an interesting piece about whatever would have been behind this door.
What do
you think about that The Hunt like limps its way out to be seen at some point in the next year?
Very, very high.
But what would change? Why, like, if they're not putting it out now, why would they put it out later?
Because everyone will stop paying attention and Trump will move on to something else and then they'll just get it out there. And because they have to fulfill their like contractual obligations at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless they think that they're going to sell fewer tickets than distribution and contract payer plays.
It'll be exclusive to the NBC Universal streaming service when that needs to.
They could do something like that. There'll be a lot of posts, I'm sure, somewhere on like, you know, IndieWire and Polygon.com. Like, oh, hey, The Hunt's out this weekend.
You're right.
I'm not necessarily convinced it will ever come out in theaters in a meaningful way, but I do believe the movie will get out there. It just feels, you know, and to explain the anger that I came out to this series, or this segment rather, I mean, it just feels like the most 2019 possible way of ending the last 10-day cycle with these shootings and everything else.
That like we're solving gun violence by canceling the release of a movie.
It's like you couldn't, like the parody of the XXX not the fucking nightmare that we're all living in parody of the fucking nightmare that we're all living in could not have come up with a more perfect finale in its banality and stupidity and nonsense.
In the end,
marveling at it.
In the end, Z for Zachariah will come out in more theaters than The Hunt. Wow.
I like Z for Zachariah.
So do I.
That movie deserved, but this will be how it gets reclaimed.
Can I just say that the third season of Glow, which came out on Netflix this weekend, is really good. And if you want your Betty Gilpin content, you should go there.
Yeah, I hope this does for Betty Gilpin's career what it did for Ann Dowd's, and that like Ann Dowd's career exploded after Compliance. So, justice for Betty. That does it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week. David's creepy wooden puffin might be on the episode too.
It's not creepy. His name is Norman. He's adorable.
Please post pictures. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them with friends, or you can tell us your own woods porn story.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm senior editor. I'm not the senior editor. What am I? The senior film critic at IndieWire. I am also Norman the Puffin's foster dad. It's Norman with three N's. It's two N's at the back end, so N-O-R-M-A-N-N. I'll post pictures on the Fighting in the War Room Twitter account. You can all those guys all be friends. You can find me on my Twitter account at David Ehrlich. You can find us all at iTunes, or on iTunes, online at iTunes. You don't have to stand in line to leave us a review. But if you do leave us a review, we will read it on the show, so please do that.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Storm A Lost Rewatch podcast. Just get hella shout-outs this week as we compare Lost to everything else. Also, way back in the review, a person who's now working with boxes at FedEx, that's also how John Locke got his start. So don't let boxes lead you to small
things. Yeah, look where
he went.
Don't
let boxes tell you what you can't do.
Yeah, exactly. check out that podcast wherever fine podcasts are found.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com and on the Little Gold Men podcast, where our book club's continuing this week. It's going to be How to Build a Girl by Caitlin Moran. It's going to be a good conversation. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-A-C-H. And we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where you can tell us about your childhood misadventures by answering this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of good boys, what adventure from your childhood should have been the basis for a movie?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.